She's your queen to be, a queen to desires. She's your queen to be, a vision of perfection, an object of affection to quench your royal fire. Completely free from infection, to be used at your discretion, waiting only for your direction. Your queen to be.
Welcome back to Kin Folklore, the Zamunda edition. All my princes and princesses out there, come with us along to this journey to a magical land of queens, the most thorough borough out of all five, all right? To seek true love. I'm Paul, and Andrea and I are cousins who love to talk about sci-fi, fantasy, and world building.
In advance of the release of Coming to America, the sequel to Coming to America, on Amazon Prime on March 5th, we thought we'd take a look back at the film that was like a huge, huge part of our childhoods. Coming to America was released nearly 33 years ago and was a huge cultural moment. In today's episode, we'll talk about some of its themes and the impact it had on Black culture and American culture at large.
Kinfolk, I didn't come here to preach to you today. You will still get your Korra content, I promise you. But today, we're gonna go to Zamunda. Let's look at Coming to America, because I feel good. And I know that there's a God somewhere. I said there's a God somewhere. The Avatar on high, looking down low. He helped Gilligan get off the island. He's gonna get you the adult content that you need in your life. Where all the royal penises are clean.
So before we start, I just need to correct the record about Queens being the best borough.
Queens is the best
borough. I'm not going to let that fly.
You got to let it fly.
I'm not going to let that fly. I'm just...
All right, listen.
It's unacceptable. Brooklyn is obviously the best borough.
Brooklyn's decent. I mean, it's cool. But he didn't go to Brooklyn. He didn't go to Kings County. He went to Queens.
Because he was looking for a queen.
Of all the places. But you know, that's what I'm saying. So he knew where he had to go. He knew the right place to be. Where else, he said, where else would you find a suitable bride?
Okay, I'm not doing this with you, but I just want the podcast audience to know that I do not endorse the statement that Queens is the best borough.
Listen, all I will say is this, is that this is a raging debate that happens all the time in New York City. So if you're not from New York City, you're just witnessing, you're a fly on the wall to what always happens. which borough is the best? And Brooklyn always thinks they got it.
We do, I mean, because we do.
Okay, all right, it's fine. We'll let you guys have that as we go through a whole journey in Queens. Go ahead.
Okay, you win. All right, so... Coming to America is a modern fairy tale about a wealthy prince from the African nation of Zamunda who comes to the United States to a borough that will not be named to escape an arranged marriage and seek an independent and intelligent American woman. Akeem sees the beautiful daughter of Cleo McDowell, who owns a McDonald's knockoff.
They got Big Mac. We got the Big Mick. They got sesame seeds on their bun. I'll have no seeds on my butt.
Akeem presents himself as a poor student from Africa to get a job at the restaurant, and he and Lisa become close over the course of the film against the wishes of both of their parents.
Yeah.
So let's just talk about some memorable moments in this movie, because this is one of the movies I feel like everybody can quote still, you know, yeah. 33 years later. Like, it's still a very quotable movie.
Every time I watch this movie, I find something new. Like, there's not one time I've watched it where I'm not like, oh, I never saw that before. Like, that is, it's amazing how you can find something new each time you watch it. I've watched it so many times.
I don't even know how many times I've seen this movie.
Yeah, it's great.
My favorite is when they actually get to Queens and Akeem is just so excited to be there. Despite the fact that we're talking about New York City in the 1980s, which is a very different New York City. There's graffiti everywhere. There's garbage everywhere. Like, the movie looks real gritty.
He runs out like, halt! And the cab driver's like, you stupid fuck! Right off the top. It's great. Oh my God. And it's so funny.
He's coming from this like beautiful homeland living in a beautiful palace where he like literally does not wash himself. He does nothing for himself. And he gets to Queens and no one even welcomes him. They're just kind of like, oh, look, tourist.
Oh God. It's so good. And they got all this luggage. The dude puts it all on the top. It's gold, solid gold, stuff inside of the luggage, which we find out later. It's just amazing. I mean, the setup, obviously seeing all the African scenes were great too. The scenes in Africa were great too. But like the contrast of that to when he arrives in the city is funny. It's hilarious to, you know, to good morning, my neighbors. Hey, fuck you.
Yes, yes.
Fuck you too.
In this last rewatch, I laugh so hard at the semi, look at this, America is great indeed. Imagine a country so free, you can throw out broken glass on the street. And I'm like, that's free.
Oh, God. Oh, man. Yeah, it's pretty funny. It's hilarious. I mean, because obviously, you know, that's not 2020 America. 2021. Thank God it's not 2020 anymore. Welcome back. That's right. It's 2021. Is this our first time talking to you guys in 2021?
I think our last.
Our last episode was in the beginning of 2021. Yeah, okay, yeah. Good, good. All right.
So I also just want to note that they made the biggest mistake when they said, let's dress like New Yorkers and look straight up like tourists. Don't do that, guys. It's not.
Don't do it. It's not it. It's not it.
You New Yorkers don't dress like that.
Secondarily, although I suffer with these things and I like it, turns out they also picked the Mets and the Jets.
I know. I noted that in my notes. And I was like, I'm not with these teams.
Listen, come on. Easy now. All right. It's like the other part is when Daryl gives, you know, Mr. McDowell the tickets to the game. He goes, oh, my dad has some extra tickets to the Jet game. I figured you might enjoy it. And I said audibly, oh, if he's going to a Jets game, he's not going to enjoy it. Like, that's not going to, it's not going to be an enjoyable experience as a Jets fan. I'm telling you.
It was a St. John's game, right?
Well, they went to a St. John's game, they went to a St. John's game, the four of them on the double date. But then Daryl, before that game, had extra tickets to a Jets game he gave to Mr. McDowell. It had nothing to do with that. Trying to impress the pops.
Yeah. Oh, my God, Daryl.
Yeah. I mean, that's a common misconception about American women. You want to get to the girl, you got to go to a father.
Not true, but
not true at all. It's so wrong. It was so wrong. Like, I was like, why is this the worst advice ever? But you know, that's what happens in barbershops. You do get some pretty bad advice sometimes.
Well, let's talk about the barbershop a little bit. So let's just note that the barbershop is incredible because like Eddie Murphy is
and Arsenio Hall, and they're everybody.
They're everybody. Yeah. They're just like the whole barbershop, except for Cuba Gooding Jr., who's getting his hair done.
Isn't it wild how many people were like very minimal? They weren't big stars at all yet. Like Cuba Gooding, Samuel Jackson, and they're all in this movie. It's crazy. Yes,
yeah. I mean, Cuba Gooding doesn't even have a line in this movie. I think it's his first appearance. And I just want to note, I never noticed him in it before until my rewatch this week. I was like, oh my God, that's Cuba Gooding Jr.
No, it's so good.
But
it's
like, so I think that this movie does a lot of great stuff about black hair and the experience, the cultural experience around black hair. Like the barbershop is where Akeem goes to get advice, which is like so true for so many black men. Like this is a place where you talk out your issues.
Yeah, it's very true.
so good. And, you know, they're always welcoming to him and give him advice, even though, you know, it's not always good advice.
Hey, the boys from Africa. No, that's true. He's in it. He fits on and says, "What you got? What you got in this?" He's all like, "Oh, I have nothing. Just juices and berries." He said, "That ain't nothing but ultra perm, boy. That ain't nothing but ultra perm." Yeah, no, it's good. And it captures a good time in history, right? It captures the moment of the Jerry curl.
Is that a good time in history?
I mean, it's a laughable moment in history. It is one of those things where you're like, wow, people really wanted their hair to look like wet and curly and
all
drip
the time.
Everywhere.
100% of the time your hair looks wet and curly.
All the things you always wanted to be. Beautiful, sexy, easiest 1, 2, 3.
Just let your soul glow. Just let it shine through. Just let your soul glow, baby. Feeling oh so silky smooth. Just let it shine through. Yeah. Just let your soul glow.
Just let your soul glow. Just let it shine through. It's the best. Oh, man, it's so good.
Did you
good.
Know anyone with a Jerry curl?
Yeah, of course. When I was a kid, I think even my grandparents had it. Like, my grandmother on my dad's side did. And then I knew a couple of people in school.
Yeah, I knew some kids. Folks in school who had Jerry curls.
And they're not lying about the whole, like, leave a print where you're sitting down. Like, that was some real shit. That's why people started putting plastic on their freaking couches and shit. That's real. That really happened.
Sogol is just so good. And it looks like a real commercial from the 80s.
1000%. I was just about to say that. Like, the commercials are exactly like, I was like, wow, that is an 80s commercial with the heads floating in the dark abyss and like everything like kind of cross dissolving going back and forth. It's great. Oh my God.
Yeah, they have that very like 80s music video vibe.
Exactly. With the real big, like, you know, horn sound in the background. It's just like wailing, like, you know, like crazy. And it's funny how they introduce Daryl like that. Every time he's coming, you know, you get that little like musical reminder. It's great. It's super great.
Yeah. So, it's, I mean, there's just so many great parts of this film. It's like hard to narrow down, you know, all of them. I also just, I think we should talk about Miss Black Awareness and the the Black Awareness pageant, which is the most like, so I just learned this. That scene was not really scripted. It was very loosely scripted. So a lot of it is just ad-libbing, and that makes it even better.
Yeah, 1000%. He's sitting here talking about, I know that there's a God somewhere. Hugh Hefner and Larry Flint, they can take pictures, but they can't make it. The Hugh Hefner on high is looking down. Like, the Hugh Hefner on high was like, that's definitely an ad lib for sure. That's crazy. That's nuts. It's so hilarious. Oh, man.
Yeah.
And then.
Oh, go ahead.
And then the, like, you know, the Randy Watson, of course. Randy Watson is like, you know, there's a Randy Watson in every, like, town in Black America somewhere.
There's a Randy Watson in every community. Like, that's a universal character. Everyone was universally like, oh, this guy.
He's good and terrible. Like, exactly. Good and terrible. He said, that boy good. That boy good. Uh-huh. Joy is hilarious. Yeah, you know, and what a name for a band. How many people, how many times have you heard somebody stomp their foot on the ground and just scream out, sexual chocolate, all the time. Sexual chocolate.
You know what's funny? Like, I didn't make the connection until, I don't know, maybe a couple years ago when I was watching this movie, that the whole sexual chocolate thing was from this movie. Because it's like, it's such a universal thing that people say and make jokes about. I never fully made the full connection here. And then maybe 2 or 3 years ago, maybe even longer than that, I was watching the movie and I was like, oh, yes, that's where this comes from.
Oh, my God. And the thing that's so funny about it, too, besides that part, is the song he's singing, The Greatest Love of All. I swear, when that song came out, You heard that at every PTA meeting, every freaking basketball game, every game, every meeting, every function. Like, everyone was singing that freaking song. And it was, I mean, it's a great song, obviously. But, like, that's why it hit so hard, too, because Randy Watson and all those black communities across the country was singing that song, guaranteed. You know what I mean? Guaranteed. Oh, man.
Yeah.
So good.
So, let's... So before they get to the Miss Black Awareness pageant, they go to this bar. I have many questions about this bar. Where is this bar? Is this bar in Queens? Is this bar in Manhattan?
We're not claiming that bar.
This bar does not give me Queens vibes. I mean, obviously, I wasn't hanging out in Queens in 1988. So, like, yeah. I don't know. But this bar gave extreme, like, you know, like Manhattan... not desirable neighborhood vibes. Like,
I mean,
a bridge and tunneler type of place where you don't, like, New Yorkers don't actually hang out, which I guess would track with the fact that they didn't know where to go.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's probably, they could have been in Manhattan because you see a lot of the scenes right there, like on Queens Boulevard, and then they're closer to, like, the 59th Street Bridge, so they're closer to the water on the other side of the city. And I'm just like, they took that train into Manhattan because that's not a Queens. Although they did say we've been to every bar in Queens.
They do say that. Oh, man. Well, you wanted to big up Queens. That's your bar now.
Listen, at least I was not Joan of Arc in my former life. Okay. Like, that's all I know. And I'm not beatboxing out here, you know, talking about.
I thought her rap wasn't that bad.
My name is Peaches, and I'm the best. All the DJs wanted to feel my breast. Like, that was like, and then she hit you with the Fat Boys beatbox. That was like a tad bit better than Sokka's rap at the poetry function. You know what I mean? That's it. You know, like, oh, man.
Listen, Peaches is putting herself out there.
She is. She is.
She's putting herself out there. The women that they meet are absolutely insane. I mean, first of all, two sets of twins, which... I was just like, this is probably a statistical anomaly.
Exactly.
And then they have multiple women who are into some kind of supernatural something. I don't want to kink shame, but then there's a woman who's like, I'm into the group thing.
Yes.
Okay. There's nothing wrong with that. That's cool if that's what you're into. They clearly were not into that. I don't know why she needed to bring that up.
Yeah. And then there was the one who was like, what's her name? She was all like, and then I'm going to star in my movies and I'm going to act in the movies. I'm going to produce the movies, but I really want to be a singer. And then I was like, yo, this lady is all over the place. And he was falling asleep at that point in the bar. It was a rough
night. I felt
like
she needed further examination. She seemed like a nice person.
She did.
She had a lot of ambition. She was excited. She was just talking about herself. Nothing wrong with that.
I mean, no, they just had, it just was like kind of crazy. I also really questioned in this scene, like, who at a bar is sitting here? Like, it was like they were doing like formal interviews. They're like sitting across the table and talking. Like, I was like, you're interviewing? Like, this is not how this would go down in a bar.
Yeah. Anyway. I mean, so much of Akeem's character, and this was some of the criticism of the film at the time, is professional.
Yeah.
Like, he approaches everything in a very professional and formal way. Yeah. And he comes off as being socially awkward, but I don't think Akeem is actually socially awkward. I think that Akeem just thinks that because of his, like, formal upbringing, that's the way to be in the world. It's just, like, a cultural mismatch entirely. You do not interview women in a bar.
Yeah. And in the face. You know, like, it's like this kind of stuff. It's like wild. He does all kinds of wild things that you're like, wait, this is okay. All right. I get it. But, you know, he's like, you know, a fish out of water, right? Like, he's in a new environment. He's figuring it out. And it makes for great comedic moments, like hilarious stuff. You know what I mean? So I'm down for it. I'm down for it. What about Simmy's snobbery?
Oh my gosh. So Simmy is one of my favorite characters in this movie because he is so ridiculous.
Super extra and ridiculous.
So ridiculous. Like, and I just want to say that, like, I'm also a person who does not like to do things that are uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to say that you know, for those of you who know me are probably like, really, she's criticizing him because this is a girl that doesn't even go camping. Like, mm-hmm. I'm like, I cannot live without internet. Like, I can't be in this this environment. So I just want to say for the record, yes, I know I too can be extra. But when he starts talking about needing a manicure, I mean, I fell out. I was just like, okay, dude, like, this job is not that, like, it's not a terrible job. Like, you're safe, you're clean. This is not like you're doing the most difficult job in the world under terrible conditions. Like, this is a legitimately fine job for someone, and you just don't want to do it because you're spoiled.
Yeah.
Super he was spoiled. Like, I can't do any more manual labor.
I'm tired of living like a peasant.
So the scene where he asked for more money after, you know, Akeem gives him the permission to fix up the apartment, and he legit buys a jacuzzi.
Why, though? Like, why the jacuzzi in that small apartment? Do you know how musty and how, like humid it was in that apartment? Oh, my God. I was just like, oh, this is not the look. And just, it triggered me in a way it hadn't because of our current state of being, like, indoors for so long. I was like, bro, I would not have made it. Like, what are you doing with the jacuzzi?
I know. I just, it was just so much. It's like, listen, he's not wrong. The apartment was obviously very poor, as Hakeem asked the super to give
them.
Well,
they desired MEGA accommodations.
the worst apartment in the building. I mean, there was literally crime tape.
Oh my God. It was like, so good.
So I get it. Yes, they could improve their accommodations, but to get a jacuzzi is, very much. And so Akeem strips him of all his money, and he writes a telegram to the king asking for additional funds. And that scene is hilarious because he's like trying to restrain himself by asking for $400,000. And the woman is like, why not just ask for like a cool meal at this point?
You do not think it would be too much? Like she has a good gauge on this, right? She's like, are you sure you really want to send this? And she reads back the note. Oh my God, it's too much, because she's definitely thinking he's full of shit, right?
Oh, like, yeah, you're really... yeah. She's like, something. This is either like a coded message or this guy's crazy. Like, 100%. She's giving him advice, like not seriously giving him advice.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously that's a plot device because it triggers his father coming to America himself to find out what's going on, right?
Well, yeah, he asked him for $1 million. I need to know why. Like, what the hell is happening that you guys need a cool meal? Like, me to send that to you? Like, what?
And also, why is Simi semi-sending it instead of Akeem, yeah, right? Like, as a parent, that was probably pretty alarming.
Yeah.
And then when they arrive, it's just, like, complete havoc. We never talked about the whole getting out of the car, roses laid at your feet thing, which again is totally ridiculous. Like, this, why are we doing this? I don't understand.
It's super wild. I don't know, but it's extra. And I mean, like, it's their custom, but it's like, and then he goes, and then he like, and then to see them have to creep out the room when he's like, if anyone throws roses at my son's feet again, they'll have to answer to me. And they like slow creep out. I was like, yo, this is wild. He's like, I'm a grown man that doesn't even know how to tie his own shoes. No, you're a prince who doesn't know how to tie his own shoes. All this shit is hilarious. These like back and forth between the two of them about this, and we'll go deeper into later in the episode about how this like plays into classism and all these other things. But it's just like, it's super funny just to see the exchanges around the rose petals, the tying of the shoes, the brushing your own teeth, the losing all of their gold, freaking gold shit in the luggage, and the dude tries to sell it back to him like he's on Delancey. Like, it was great.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things about the movie that I think makes it like a very effective comedy, is everything is so ridiculous.
Yeah.
Nothing is just kind of reasonable and normal. Everything is outscaled ridiculousness. Like, we just have this whole situation where they're in Zamunda and everything is ridiculous because he's being waited on in a way that I cannot imagine even real royals get waited on. Yeah. I mean, come on. And then when they get to New York, it's like an exaggeration of what New York is. Like, as soon as they get there, all of their stuff is stolen. There's an apartment with crime scene tape that is rented to them. It's just an exaggeration hyperbole around everything, around our society, around this like fictional African kingdom and the opulence that comes with being royalty. And it's funny. Like, all of those things make the whole movie hilarious because it's absurd.
Yeah. It's wild. The bathers are quite absurd. It's pretty hilarious.
It's ridiculous. It is absolutely ridiculous. And one of the things that makes Akeem a character that we enjoy is that Akeem very much recognizes how ridiculous it is and doesn't approve of any of it. Akeem is a very pure hero in that he believes like giving all people the same respect and treating people in a way that they deserve to be treated with humanity. And he also just thinks that all of this, like the money he's in a position of privilege where it means nothing to him. Right. And I think that puts him at contrast with Cleo, Lisa's father, who has had to work for everything he ever needs. And so that status and in the symbolism of like needing to have certain things and have a certain household, that stuff is very important to him.
Yeah. And you can see the contrast really clearly in a later conversation, right? When they're inside of Cleo's house and he's talking about, you know, you work hard enough and maybe in 20, 30 years, you too can have something like this. And Hakeem could have obviously doesn't want to blow his cover, but he was, you know, really respectful in that moment. He was like, yeah, you know, that's, I imagine, like, that'd be cool. Like, kind of, he didn't play him. Like, it wasn't like, oh, yeah, you're whack, you know, like, you don't even understand who I am kind of thing. Like, no flexing going on with Hakeem. He was, like, very understated. So I appreciate that about his character for sure. But
yeah, his character is really a contrast to all the other men who are very stuck in their status and position. And of course, like, as I said, Akeem has the privilege of never having to work. This is his first job, right? Yeah. And he's always been waited on. He doesn't even know how to mop a floor.
That's a great scene with the freaking mop inside the bucket.
This is a random reference that many people won't get, but as you and I are both Downton Abbey fans, and it reminded me of when Lady Sybil tried to boil a kettle. God.
So good. This is a very good comp.
They were like, everyone in the kitchen was laughing at her. I was like, yep, same energy.
This is a
energy.
Very good comp. I agree 1,000%. Like, everyone's like, yeah, let us take over. Okay. Like, yeah. And you know how I feel about Sibby. She's, you know.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
That's for all our Downton folks. But yeah, no. I agree. I think, you know, it's a strong contrast to King Jaffe Jofa, who's out here talking about, I always just assumed you slept with your bathers. I know I do. Oh my God, what?
Yeah, it was,
I mean,
not a strong
no,
father figure.
No, not at all. Oh my God, it's terrible. It's like, you do know that you're married to his mom. Like, what are you talking about? It's wild. It's super wild. But James, and there's so many good Easter eggs in here too. Like, you know, like James Earl Jones literally says a quote directly from Star Wars in the film. Like, I didn't catch that until this watch. I'd watched it so many freaking times but the scene when he's talking at McDowell's and he's like, I'll deal with him myself. That's a direct quote from like Darth Vader talking in Return of the Jedi. And I caught it. And I was like, why does that remind me of something? And I looked it up and I was like, holy shit. Like, that is a direct quote. And then the Trading Places Easter egg. There's so many good things in here, man. I just love this. I love this show. I love this movie.
Yeah, it's, I mean, this, so I actually was very surprised when I looked up the, like, what the reception was at a time, because by the time I saw this movie had been out for several years. Like, it, I never saw this in the movie theater. I was too young when it came out. I saw this movie on, you know, we're dating ourselves, but VHS. or like on television. Like, I never actually saw this movie in the theater. And by then it was like a must watch. Like, I remember my mother, the first time we saw it together, was like, this is like one of the funniest movies. I love this movie. So I was surprised to see that the reviews when it came out were mixed, that this is a film that was not exactly taken seriously and wasn't well received. And I think some of that is the fact that it came out at a time where, like, Black movies didn't always have the best reception. I mean, the 80s were actually very robust in Black movies. Like, there weren't as many as there should have been, right? But there were more than we tend to see now. But the reception was like, they had all these amazing actors like James L. Jones in it, and they didn't really use them. I think he's perfect in this movie. Like, this is my first impression, maybe because it was my first impression of James Earl Jones. I thought his delivery was great. Like, he had good timing. He's also very formal. You know, he's a king, and he's older. But I thought he was wonderful in this. And, you know, Eddie Murphy is, people talk a lot in the criticism about Eddie Murphy's performance as Akeem is just being very like rigid, but that was intentional. But then also we got to give him props because he's like eight people in this movie.
So many versions of Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. It's pretty crazy. It's like, it's super duper wild to watch them inhabit all these different characters. And it took me a while, like I told you offline, as a kid, to realize that he was even the white Jewish guy in the barbershop. When I was a kid, I was like, what? That's him? Like, it was mind-boggling to me. And I think, you know, part of the reception, too, I think, back in the 80s, probably had to do with the fact that he was doing all of these cop movies, and he was doing all these buddy movies, and people wanted him to keep doing those things. And I think he took this opportunity to, like, do something that was very different. A king and a prince in Africa. You know, like, and this is not a portrayal that we saw a lot in Hollywood. So he used his power to really, like, portray these things. And there's mixed reviews from people about how well it was portrayed. But it is still something that I think, like, that was important in the moment. You know what I mean? Because people weren't really doing that on screen, you know? So. And we got Zamunda. We didn't get Zamunda before Wakanda because literally Wakanda was in the comics. But on screen, we did get Zamunda before we got what we got in Black Panther, the movie, later on. And obviously they handle Africa and the continent very differently. But I do, this was a moment, right, where people in the 80s, a lot of the movements that we see now that we talk about, people in the 80s were waking up to this, like, you know, these ideas about, like, you know, African lineage and heritage and being proud about our African ancestry. I was rocking the African medallion chain as a little kid with the leather rope and, like, you know, going to rallies with my dad. So it was a thing that people were waking up to. So he really hit, I think, a chord in the hate to use this word, but in the zeitgeist and the culture, right? Like, this is what was happening in people's awareness, and he, like, kind of, like, tapped into it.
100%. So should we talk a little bit more about themes since we started heading that way? So one of the major themes that I noticed in the film was just, like, the classism, right? So there's a lot, and I think we see this actually in a lot of 80s movies, that class becomes almost its own character. So, like, Akeem is wealthy, he's wealthier than all of them. We're talking about, like, beyond, like, you know, the what type of wealth that they could even really understand. Like, if Simi can just ask for a cool million.
I mean, he took the whole knot, and he just, like, he just dropped it inside the offering basket too. He was like, yo, give me that, and took it out the money clip and just dropped it in, and he wasn't even worried about it. And they still have more money. Every time you saw them, they had bundles of cash. It was crazy. It's nuts.
Yeah, I mean, actual gold stuff. And so it's very interesting to see that both Daryl, who is like basically the antagonist of this film, there's really no villain. Daryl's the closest thing we really get to a villain. And Lisa's father, Cleo, both look down on him because they think he's like poor and uneducated, and they have these notions that like manual labor is unsuitable and beneath them. And when Lisa speaks to her father about his bias against Akeem, he basically says it's coming from a place of like, he doesn't want her to struggle the way that her parents did. And I think that's a really relatable thing. A lot of Black parents fought really hard to get into the middle class, and they don't want their kids to struggle the same way that they did. So I think that like Cleo is coming from a place of like, yes, like hard work is important, but you know, you shouldn't have to struggle the way that we did. Daryl's just like lazy, snobby.
Yeah.
There's no defense of Daryl. I mean,
but he's also he's privileged and in that lazy kind of like snotty mode because his parents have kind of like made him that way, in the sense of like, they also are doing what Cleo was describing, right? They did that already. They like made this, you know, hair product empire. They're flush with cash, and they're like, oh yeah, my son is like gonna, you know, not have to deal with all the things that we've dealt with. And then you hear like Daryl's whole perspective on work, because he's definitely trying to convince Lisa that she doesn't need this job, she doesn't need to work, he could take care of her, which is like, you know, how he's experiencing like what it is to care about somebody, because that's how his parents have treated him. So I get that perspective. He's kind of like coddled because his parents didn't want him to suffer. And that's kind of what Cleo's saying to her, Lisa. And Lisa's like, I'm not having it.
Yeah, I mean, I think Daryl is what Akeem could have been, right? Like, he is there to contrast it. Akeem could be like him. He could be this person. He could be more like Semi, who doesn't want to work and wants to be served and doesn't and values material things in this way. Daryl's also very cheap, which Akeem is not. He's very generous. And so, yes, I think that his background definitely plays a role in that. But Daryl's bias goes a little further than class, because he also has these like very terrible views about Africa. Like, he regularly makes jokes about how primitive he believes that Akeem and Simi's lifestyles are. And the jokes are terrible. Like, they're not even good jokes. Like, they're jokes that make him look like a bad person. And I think that's the intent of them. But he kind of lumps in the whole continent. Like, everybody lives in like a village, and they don't wear clothes, and they don't have access to technology or education. Akeem is literally a student. Mm-hmm. That's what he told you. I mean, he's not, but like, that's what he told 100%. You. So obviously he had access to education. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with living outside of modern life, like, as long as that's not because somebody else has taken the resources from you. But Africans have diverse and rich cultures and societies. But like in America, like, we tend to lump in the whole continent into this idea of like the biased depictions of Africans as being impoverished and not having access to technology, not being technologically savvy. And Daryl really, like, he totally buys into that narrative in a way that is deeply uncomfortable and makes me dislike him even more. Like, he's a really very unlikable character.
And you know, but I think he's a stand-in for a conversation, like, as a kid, that I remember happening at Black dinner tables across the country in America, right? This very much, there was very much on the heels of like, the Back to Africa movement, and there was a lot of Pan-Africanism that was happening, and there was also this very traditionalist kind of like Black American view that was like, you know, steeped in some of the traditions of, you know, church and the South and a lot of things there. And I remember those conversations and that conflict as a kid, hearing different people talk about their viewpoint of Africa versus people who were awakening to some of the things that we all know now to be true about society, because this is 1988. You know, Jesse Jackson's running for president, and we're on the heels of, like, you know, all the things that we went through for in the civil rights movement. And people are still not, you know, we're not framing ourselves as, like, you know, we're not talking on the level that we are now, how we see being an African person of African descent in popular culture in 1988. So he's kind of a stand-in for that other side of the debate, right? Like, that was being had across. I remember these conversations in my household anyway. I definitely feel like there was a conflict that was happening in America at that moment where some people were awake to, like, African culture and some people were not. And there was, like, this debate that was happening. These two characters are a great stand-in for that debate.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that even now you see Americans assuming, making assumptions about how Africans live. And the truth is that most mm-hmm. of us don't know anything about yep. Africa. I mean, let's just be honest. Like, we don't learn about Africa in school. And when we do, it's sort of lumped in as the continent as one place. I learned a lot more about South Africa than the rest of the continent when I was in school, in part because apartheid was still in place, and the fight to end it was a global debate that was happening. But I just feel that Daryl's bias is intentionally written in to be as you said, a stand-in for this conversation where we kind of assume that the African children who are on these commercials, who are struggling, right? Like Save the Children and in all those nonprofits, are sometimes the only depictions of Africans that Americans see. And that just speaks to the power of this movie. It doesn't introduce us to an African country that is impoverished or in the midst of a civil war or conflict or a famine. It introduces us to a place that has been untouched by imperialism. And we'll talk a little bit more about, like, Wakanda and Zamunda and what they mean later. But his jokes were just so rough for me to hear, especially in the current context.
They're trash jokes. And it's also interesting to see kind of Hakim's his view of America, right, through his eyes in this movie, when he talks about and remarks about the freedom of America. And, you know, both Hakim and Lisa find it difficult to make their own choices, and, you know, in the context of being young people and also in their family structure. They feel responsible for their family's legacies, despite the fact that their families are in very different positions, right? It's interesting somehow to consider that, you know, the freedom impacts people in many different ways. You know, Hakim believes himself to be oppressed by the expectations of his family, right? So that's his idea of, even though he has all this, you know, wealth and he's going to be king one day, he feels oppressed by the idea of the tradition, like the tradition and of classism and the monarchy in his country feels oppressive to him. But, you know, he could also be looked at as a privileged person because he's a future king. And similarly, Lisa feels oppressed by a lot of things. Like, she feels oppressed by her dad's expectations, by Daryl's way of treating her as, like, somebody who needs to be, you know, told what they want. And all of these ideas, when she's a very independent and intelligent person who is actually, in a lot of ways, has a similar moral sense to Hakim, but also is helping that business stay afloat. Like, look at all the work that she's doing to keep McDowell's mm-hmm. actually running. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, you know, concern around like tradition and expectations has felt oppressive for both of them. And it's interesting to see how they navigate that with the backdrop of Hakim's view on American freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. I noticed that freedom was a word that Hakim used a lot when he arrived to America. And it's interesting to think of someone who is going to be the ruler of a society thinking America mm-hmm. is more free, right? And also there's a disconnect never really addressed in the movie. And I think in part because this is not mm-hmm. intended to be like a struggle film, but never really addressed is the oppression of mm-hmm. Black people in America. Like, you see images of the neighborhood that they live in being not as clean as other is, you know, Manhattan. Like, the cabbie mm-hmm. even says, like, why are you going to Queens? Like, you should be going, guys like you should be going to Manhattan. But, like, that dynamic within New York City exists all over this country, where Black people are segregated and live are unable to live in neighborhoods that are actually cared for by yeah. the city and by society at large. And that's not really addressed in the movie. And I think that that's an intentional choice. I think they didn't want this movie to be a movie about yeah. race. I just was struck by the fact that Akeem is showing up and he sees America as free, but, you know, maybe if he had spoken to some of his neighbors, they would have talked about how America is not free yeah. for Black people, especially in the 80s. It is an interesting dynamic.
I agree, and it leads into some of the things around, you know, prejudice that's addressed in this film. You know, there's a lot of assumptions in this film from King Joffrey, who assumes that his son wants to go to America to just sow his royal oats and have some fun before he returns and just does what everyone traditionally has done in their society. Lisa assumes that Hakeem is very poor because he's a custodian and, you know, he works for her father. And Daryl assumes that Hakeem is ignorant because he's from Africa. So all these assumptions that we're seeing. Cleo assumes Hakeem needs tutelage to break into the Black middle class. And finally, King Joffrey also assumes that Lisa and Cleo are beneath his family because they're basically commoners in his eyes. When faced with their prejudices, everyone realizes that they really have miscalculated who everyone is and sees the errors of their assumptions. And this was really powerful for me actually on this watch in the context of lived experience. And, you know, it had been years since I caught it, since I watched it from like top to bottom twice in a row. Like, it had been like I've watched it when it's on TV or when a friend's watching it. And I caught it like from different points in the movie. And what mm-hmm. really... Mm-hmm. Was really interesting to me on the context of what you're saying about freedom and Hakeem's like experience is that it shows you this idea about like us as Black people who were the descendants of slaves, like feeling like this upward climb to the middle class and what that felt like for us living in this country versus like maybe what we made assumptions about how people were living back in the places where many of us came from. Because I think there was a lot of talk back then about everyone's kings and queens, which was an assumption also. We're not all, everyone that lived in Africa was not a king and a queen. I'm sure there were commoners there also, but that was a lot of mm-hmm. the conversations in the 80s anyway, about like we're kings, the descendants of kings and queens and all these other things, which obviously we still, you know, hold on to in the popular culture, how we speak about things. But I do think like that's an assumption that is also a nuance about these two things, freedom and prejudice, that's in this film, but not overtly spoken about, but implied so that you can have a good time just laughing and it's fun and it's lighthearted. But if you really look closer, you can see that.
Yeah, 100%. So since we've been talking about the context of the film and what was happening in the 80s, let's talk a little bit about the, like how this film was received. We've already kind of discussed it, but
yeah,
this was okay. Can we just say that 1988 was a really good year for movies?
Yeah, it was.
There were some incredible films that came out that year. But what I found really interesting was that despite this movie having mixed reviews, especially from like very, elite publications, mm-hmm. like the, so Siskel and Ebert were mixed on it. Siskel mm-hmm. really liked it. Ebert really didn't like it. I wonder if Roger Ebert had a chance to revisit the film later, he would have felt differently about mm-hmm. it, because he certainly evolved as a critic over time. Mm-hmm. The Washington Post gave it an absolute, I read the whole review yesterday, and they gave it an absolutely scathing review. Mm-hmm. Like, it's basically like, you know, why would you get this ensemble cast and then give them nothing to do? Like, it's essentially said this movie is a joke.
Wow.
But interestingly, the movie did very, very well in terms of grossing, you know, first of all, it was one, I think it was the highest earning film of that year, which means, you know, when you calculate how much it cost to make it and then how much it earned. So it, the film earned quite a bit. But in addition, it beat Big.
Wow.
Die Hard.
Wow.
It beat Die Hard.
I know, that's kind of crazy.
At
that's,
the box office. That's kind of crazy. I was just like, this is, it, that makes so much sense now, but like considering the influence, that's another movie that people quote from.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
You know, it, it was the third highest grossing film of 1988. And let's just acknowledge how important that is as a Black film. That, I mean, okay, I do want to address a little bit whether or not we consider this a Black film. The director and writers and producers are not, were white.
Mm-hmm.
The story was based on Eddie Murphy's idea, and that's also in contention because there was another project, you know, there was a loss, there's litigation around this. There was mm-hmm. another project that also had him attached with a similar idea. So I don't want to get too much into that because that's been settled, mm-hmm. but, you know, it is a, in my opinion, this is, this still qualifies as a Black movie, the same way as I believe The Color Purple qualifies as a Black movie, despite being both written and directed by white men.
Yeah.
These movies were made for mainstream appeal, but outside, like, these are movies that are, there's very few white characters. They do not center whiteness. They center Blackness. And so I consider it a Black film. Do you?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think one person that would probably so I'm nuanced about it, right? Because I don't consider it a Black film from the standpoint of, you know, ownership, right? I don't know whether Eddie owns this movie or not, or like how much ownership he has of the movie, which is something that's interesting, right? Because that intellectual property ownership is really where it comes down to, where mm-hmm, I would say, yeah, mm-hmm. this is a black film because the people who own the intellectual property would be them. But I do, you know, obviously it's an ensemble cast that's predominantly Black, and that was not something that was happening at that time. But I think a person that would kind of really kind of challenge us on the Blackness of this film from the standpoint of the directors and producers would be somebody like August Wilson, who was very outspoken about the fact that there were plenty of Black directors that were available in the 80s for movies like Coming to America and The Color Purple and these other films that were overlooked, him being one of them. And, you know, truthfully, we're only getting to experience the mastery of his work through the lens of Denzel Washington producing them with his production company all these years later, because of the fact that he was blacklisted because there weren't directors who were getting shots in Hollywood based on him being outspoken about those comments. So I kind of hedge a little bit because I kind of feel like a lot of Black directors were thrown under the bus when trying to fight for the opportunity to direct movies like this. And I think Eddie could have pushed with his power in Hollywood to make that a thing. And, you know, I don't think the consciousness around all of us in the community was there to really say, nah, this is the way I'm going to pull, you know, I'm going to kind of use my power and leverage to get it done. You know what I mean? So that's what I think.
Yeah. About. Yeah. And I think that that's fair. I think that's a fair criticism of this film. I think that's a fair criticism of The Color Purple. You know, I do, having Black creators really makes a difference, and mm-hmm. and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the issues with the film later, but like, I totally agree with that. I consider it to be a Black film. I am not the, you know, the authority on what is a Black film. So mm-hmm. it's just my opinion.
Yeah.
But having a fully Black cast, the only white character, well, there's two supporting characters who are white in this film, mm-hmm. but the one who has the most speaking lines is played by Eddie Murphy, which is remarkable. So to me, this counts as a Black film because it centers Blackness. But yes, I think you're right. That's a fair criticism of you know, categorizing it as a Black mm-hmm. film. Is it really? Are these Black things when we didn't create them, we don't own the rights to them? Like, that's a fair assessment.
Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know. And again, I haven't gone through it and been like, hey, who owns intellectual property? Like, I don't know. You know what I mean? I look at it like that. I also think like it's profound that, you know, Eddie was able to fight to get like Nile Rodgers to be like the person who did the music, right? Like that's huge. Like he wasn't known for doing musical scores. So that's also another big thing. The fact that they allowed him to play multiple characters in a movie, that's also cool. I mean, Louis Anderson is, you know, in it as another white character as well. But he also, he is not centered in the movie. He's kind of like a real supporting cast. So I agree with you that it's a predominantly black film. It just, my hesitation and just want to give my full view on it is just like, I really like to see black directors and producers get a shot. You know what I mean?
I agree. Yeah. And the sequel is also being directed by a white man.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I this director also directed Dolomite Is My Name, and I had said to you earlier offline that mm-hmm. I had that I'm not, you know, we'll see if the sequel is going to be any good, but I have a little bit more faith because I really like that movie and I think it was very well done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that they bring that same energy and enthusiasm to the sequel.
Yeah, and Kenya Barris is one of the writers, so he really got in the writer's room, so we'll see what happens there, you know, like...
Yeah, and Eddie Murphy is a producer,
yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, the cast is insane, so yeah. I'm not even, like, we don't even have time to read the cast, like, everyone in Black Hollywood is this exactly. movie almost, like, it's an incredible cast that they got together. So did you want to talk a little bit more about, like, the influence of the film?
Yeah, sure. I definitely want to talk about, like, you know, Coming to America being a film about black people, like we kind of talked about, and for black people. It was definitely, you could tell that this was who they wanted to make the movie for. This is why Eddie wanted to make this movie. It feels very clear in that way, which is why the conversation we're having, you know, feels important to have. But Coming to America is essentially a fairy tale. Like we had never really seen something like this on the screen at that moment. I know being a young kid at that time, this was the first time I was seeing something like this. And it did make a difference. It marked me as like, oh, as a person that I had a value for it. It centers on the African diaspora and, you know, Coming to America asks us to imagine an African country untouched by imperialism, with heredity in the monarchy and extreme wealth. Whether intended or not, the film, you know, was made kind of outside of the white gaze because of Eddie's influence in Hollywood at that moment. Like it definitely had like this thing where it's like, this is how he sees Africa in this moment. This is how he sees Black America in this moment. And you know, the jokes are only those that a lot of the jokes are jokes that they'll go over your head unless you are in the black community, right? Some of them are like, you know, again, there is a Randy Watson in every city across America. You know what I mean? Those conversations about, you know, that's day one. Every time you bring up Joe Louis, somebody got to bring up Rocky Marciano. You know, like that happens all the time, especially at that time, about boxing in America. And the, you know, the idea of like somebody who was going to beat like, you know, a black heavyweight champion. Right. So all of that stuff is very much a part of the culture. And it was very geared towards conversations that we have, you know, in our culture as black people. And I think that is, in fact, a beautiful part of this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really good. And we've talked a little bit about Wakanda and it's similar in a lot of ways. I don't think you can separate Zamunda and Wakanda. Mm-hmm. Like they're the notion of a wealthy country that was not, you know, the resources have not been pillaged, that it was not taken over by a European power. I don't think that we can really separate that these are, you know, this is like the Africa that could have been. Mm-hmm. That's what in our imagination that the African countries could have been, you know, independently wealthy and successful without the meddling of, you know, colonizers, mm-hmm. for lack of a better mm-hmm. word. And so when thinking about Zamunda and Wakanda, I think we also just have to think about the fact that these films are also essentially free of interracial conflict, mm-hmm. right? The conflict within the films are between Black people.
And families. Yep, exactly. Yeah.
They're both stories that are heavily about family and family conflict. Mm-hmm. They both primarily feature a prince who has to hide some part of his identity.
Yep.
When he's not in his homeland, when you really think about what T'Challa and Akeem both have to do when they're outside of Wakanda and Zamunda, is that they have to downplay who they are. Mm-hmm. T'Challa has to be careful about keeping Wakanda's advanced technology and his identity as the Black Panther, and also the wealth of Wakanda, right? Like, multiple times in the movie Black Panther, it's commented that, you know, it's a small, impoverished nation, mm-hmm. and it's anything but that. But that's the image that they wanted to give to the outside world out of that fear of imperialism and colonization. And Akeem has to, when he gets to New York, he hides his wealth and identity because he also feels that people might take advantage of that. He wants a woman to love him for who he is. He doesn't want a woman to love him because she wants to be queen. And they both make use of the Western world's negative views and dismissals of Africa to kind of keep themselves insulated from being taken advantage of. And I think that when we think about like the immigrant identity, I think a lot of immigrant people can relate to, you know, not always sharing their full selves when they're in spaces that are American spaces.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I just thought about this as you were talking about the fact that it's pretty interesting that this is made by both these films that we're talking about originated from like Black people are like, you know, the creative are very heavily creative in it that are from America. And the mm-hmm. reason why I find that interesting is because I also think what you're describing is this American thing that we have to do of code switching, right? Like, we have mm-hmm. to like be one way in our community, and then we kind of switch for like the general, you know, population. And that's something that's been on high, you know, especially like when you're switching from like, you know, I remember when I was a kid, it was like, oh, I speak like, you know, how we speak, and I speak job interview. Like, that was like a real kind of thing, right? People used to say that all the time. And I think, you know, we've worked really hard to not make that a thing, especially in this last year. I think we've put, you know, especially, you know, after everything that happened last year in the summertime with George Floyd and all of the conversations that were being had by a lot of corporations about how people of color are treated within those spaces. I think I hope that conversation continues, because there's a lot of forward movement there. But I do find it fascinating. I thought about it as you were speaking about it, how much T'Challa underplaying who he is when he's in America and in other parts of the world, and Hakeem doing the same thing, and that these films were made from the American perspective really mm-hmm. does serve as an, you know, analogy for code switching in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it goes both ways too, because I think Black Americans have to code switch, and so do immigrants from every kind of background, because there's a sense that Americans won't accept mm-hmm. who you really are, or that someone might take advantage of it or try to exploit it. And I think that, you know, that's a parallel that I see really strongly between these two films. And the last time I watched Coming to America was shortly after I had rewatched Black Panther, around the time that Chadwick Boseman had passed. I went on this kind of binge of like watching all of the Black movies from my youth, because I think that they celebrate Blackness in a way that we're not used to seeing in the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And so both films present like an alternative narrative to what could be. And I think that's really important for us to do, especially when we're struggling. That inspiration of what could be, what we, you know, celebrating our greatness is important, is just as important as celebrating struggle.
100%. So things did not, there's some things that did not age well. some things that did not age well in 2021 versus 1988, and let's talk about some of those. What did you think about some of those things?
Yeah, so with the coming of the sequel, which is highly anticipated. There's been some articles written about colorism in the film, and I'm glad to see this conversation come up because it is something that I, as a child, had noted, which is sort of the brown and dark-skinned women in this film are postured very differently than Lisa, who is very fair complected. And so I just think that we should acknowledge it. The actress who played Princess Amani, who is supposed to be Akeem's bride, her name is Vanessa Bell Calloway. I believe she is actually going to be in the sequel, so I don't think there's a lot of beef there. Okay. But she is depicted as being very servile and undesirable to him because she doesn't have a personality. Mm-hmm. You know, she's given very little agency. And she had originally auditioned to play Lisa, and she felt that the casting, those who were in charge of the casting, chose her for this role instead because of her skin color. Mm. And it's hard to see, knowing that she feels that way. And, you know, let's acknowledge that I don't think that what she's saying, it sounds crazy, right? Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's very possible, because we do often see that in Hollywood colorism exists.
Yeah, we talked about that offline, right, with Aunt Viv and the whole thing that happened there with the Fresh Prince recently, when we saw that recap interview with the original Aunt Vivian and Will Smith, and how those dynamics were at play there too, where they replaced her, like they replaced her with someone who looked nothing like the original Aunt Viv and was a lot lighter. So, like, yeah, for sure, that this is something that happens a lot in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I think most people who are paying attention have noted that Hollywood has this issue. And I mean, society has this issue. But, you know, knowing that she made these claims and then watching the movie and watching this woman literally hopping on one foot and barking like a dog, it's bad. Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't look great. And then it's been noted by some writers before that even the dynamic between, you know, Patrice, who is Lisa's sister, I don't think we've really talked a lot about mm-hmm. her, and Lisa, where Patrice is supposed to be this, like, gold-digging, you know, fast mm-hmm. young woman, and Lisa is more supposed to be the, like, moral high ground and very well put together. That dynamic, too, is an issue. Now, as I said earlier to you when we were talking about this, I love Patrice. Mm-hmm. I think she's a great character. She has great spirit. Of course, it's not a great look for her to dump Akeem as soon as she learns it falsely, obviously, that Semi is the prince.
What a great move by Semi, though, like, to be like, I know, great.
What a smart move, because, like, he got out of hot water with Akeem as well, because it doesn't ruin his chances with Lisa. He's pretending that Akeem is his servant. Yeah. It's fast thinking, Semi. But she, like, immediately dumps Akeem, and it's not a great look for her. But otherwise, I find her character to be awesome. Like, she is fun. She has a lot of freedom. She doesn't, you know, she's just like, she's not living in a space where she's like, this is how I have to be in the world. She's trying to be someone who's, like, a little bit more free with her personality. And so I like her character, but I think that, you know, we should acknowledge that this is an issue within the film.
Again, with the comps between Zamunda and Wakanda, although she's not from Zamunda, we were saying earlier when we were talking, like, before we started, like, you know, taping the episode, how the comp I see between, you know, Patrice and Shuri, of, like, their fun attitude, like their upbeat, mm-hmm. lively. I was like, wow.
Being comfortable in their own skin.
Comfortable in their own skin. Both, yep.
100%. Yeah.
So I really like, I like her character too. I think she's, like, really funny. As I said to you, I've known, you know, Lisa and Patrice in Queens, you know, like, growing up there. So that is definitely true. But I definitely see what you know, we talked a little bit about it. I definitely see, you know, that this is something that I hope that they address in this film. And it looks like, you know, the cast seems very diverse in different aspects of our community. So we'll see what they do. And another thing that's kind of on there that we kind of talked about too was, and it's really hit on too, with the whole barking like a dog thing and a lot of other things, with some of the treatment of, like, you know, sexism in the film. Like, you see it in mm-hmm. Daryl, like, just deciding that, he's going to get married to Lisa, never speaking to her about it and kind of telling Akeem, you know, you got to sometimes tell a woman what she wants, and not asking for consent is implied there. And so there's definitely issues there that I'm pretty certain, especially in our world now, that they'll clean up. You know what I mean? In the second episode.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be very disappointed in the sequel if they treat women as badly. I mean, we're not picking on this film because a lot of movies in the 80s, yeah, and a lot of movies even now, yeah, are, you know, have other like outwardly racist or sexist themes and narratives, or it's, you know, more subtle. But we have to note the first half hour of the movie is really rough on women. Like, all of the women are essentially servants or are depicted as being in some way undesirable. Yeah. And until we meet Lisa. And so I think that that's not great, you know, for the film. Lisa's also really the only woman in the movie that has a real voice. Mm-hmm. And I get why that may have happened in this movie, but, you know, it doesn't look great.
Yeah, I agree.
And then, you know, the final thing I just wanted to note about the movie that maybe is controversial, and I don't want to speak for, you know, people who live on the continent. I don't want to speak for people from African nations, but I think it was Essence did a like retrospective a few years mm-hmm. ago, and they interviewed people, Africans living in the United States. So that's, you know, also not representative of everyone, to see how they felt about the film. And they definitely, there was a mixture of responses. A lot of African people thought that the movie was great. They loved it. They thought it was, you know, it was something that they also watched a lot as children. Mm-hmm. And then some people said that they found the depictions of Africa to be offensive. And I think that that's fair. You know, I don't think that Coming to America took as much care is Black Panther did in playing homage to Africa. Mm-hmm. So I think that naturally, obviously from an American point of view, you're still going to see some bias and some things that just don't hit right. And cultural mismatches, right? One person had commented about how the costuming didn't even make sense when they were in Africa. They were pulling from many different parts of Africa mm-hmm. with this kind of like cultures that don't even interact much because they're on different parts of the mm-hmm. continent. So anyway, I just thought we should note those things.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the way from a creator standpoint, they probably would say, well, you know, because it's a fictitious place, we probably did pull from a lot of different things to make up our own kind of like cultural backdrop. But I do think, like, you're right. You can tell the difference in obviously, like, we're like you said, 30 something years down the road. So it's a different moment when they're making Black Panther. But, you know, there's countless stories about the time that they spent in Africa and the conversations that they had, and the not only the research, but even down to the soundtrack. You know, Ryan Coogler made the producers of the music go and actually like work with African musicians to get a real sense of, like, not just like, hey, we're just going to approximate it. We're going to have an authentic, actual musical experience, visual experience, cultural experience as close as we can get making a movie in the Disney Corporation and being American filmmakers. So I thought, you know, and it'll be interesting because they both these films, besides just the comp of, like, you know, African culture meets American culture, there is also the comp of, like, they both were shot on the same soundstage. So how do they do that, right? Like, they both were shot at Tyler Perry Studios, both these films. So I'd be really interested to see, like, how they deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, as you said, that Black Panther had a different approach, but Black Panther also drew from mm-hmm. many cultures. And I think they were just more careful mm-hmm. about it. So, you know, we'll see how the sequel is done. I'm looking forward to seeing what it is. It's either going to be awesome or terrible.
Yeah. I mean, I'm excited. I'm actually excited. We're only, you know, when you guys are listening to this, we're going to be a week away, you know, from the movie. And I'm really excited. And, you know, maybe we should talk about the Babar elephant in the room. You know, he did say, hey, Babar, and pat him on the head. We should talk about the elephant in the room. which is Cora. Yeah, she's coming. You know, like, it's happening. She's the Avatar, and you have to deal with it. Like, this is what it is. Okay, but we wanted to do something here just to kind of, like, take a moment for Black History Month and, you know, on the before we get into Korra, to kind of just acknowledge, you know, a movie that, as Andrew said at the top of the episode, that really marked us as creative people and lovers of, like, movies and culture. And so Korra's up next. Here it comes.
Yeah, I'm excited for Korra. There's so much to talk about. I'm hyped.
Super hyped. And we're going to do some coverage of the comics. So in between, that gets us from the final battle to the days in Republic City. So yeah, stay tuned. And that'll be coming up here for you guys. And we hope you know, enjoyed going back to talk about, you know, Zamunda. And hope you enjoy the movie when it drops. And we look forward to engaging on this full season of Korra with you guys.
Yeah, we're excited.
Cool. See you soon.
Bye, everyone.